Most criminology experts and law enforcement officials have rejected the idea that capital punishment is a deterrent to crime. Still today, the United States has 34 death penalty states, 3,199 inmates on death row, and since 1976 has carried out 1,276 executions. In his latest documentary project called Death Row Portraits, filmmaker Werner Herzog moves away from the discussion and debate over the morality of capital punishment and simply turns his camera on death row inmates as a way of understanding their crimes and their frames of mind as they await death by lethal injection. Short versions of the interviews with five inmates in the Texas and Florida prison systems have already aired on the cable channel Investigation Discovery, but the director's cuts of the films are being screened today and tomorrow at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village with a filmmaker discussion afterwards on both nights. I'm very pleased to welcome Werner Herzog back to our show. Hi.
Hello. Nice to talk to you again. I always enjoy it.
It seems that there are a lot of prison shows looking at every aspect of prison life on American cable television. Why do you suppose the public has such a fascination with the life of prisoners?
It's very hard to really say, but I am under the impression that it's mostly women, because the commercials in between are mostly commercials for women. So the audience, the core audience, are females, and for them, apparently, it's seeing the fear out there, the intimidating ones, the threats to them, but they are behind bars, or in my case, behind a bulletproof glass wall. Very, very difficult to really make an assessment, but crime TV is very popular in the United States and in other parts of the world, and I immediately set out, I said to Investigation Discovery, I would like to lift it to a much higher level.
Well, the four documentaries that make up Death Row Portraits were created as a companion to your film Into the Abyss about a triple homicide in Texas. Why did you decide to release them as separate, nearly hour-long films? Why not integrate all four into one documentary?
Yeah, that was the intention originally. I wanted to make a film which included everyone, and then immediately when I started editing, I realized that Into the Abyss was such a huge project, that it was such an American gothic, had such substance and such an intensity, it had to be a separate a project on its own. But since I had started filming with other inmates, I continued, and I decided together with my co-producer and the network, we would do four separate shorter films that were only portraits of inmates on death row. And so we proceeded with that, and I'm glad that I did it this way and separated it. By the way, it's not director's cut what the audiences are going to see tonight and tomorrow. All four films in some sort of a double feature, or rather quadruple feature, mm-hmm. with discourse in between, are not director's cut. It's the international version, which is 52 minutes long. So I had to be very precise. When you work for American television, it means 1 hour would be 42 minutes. The rest is filled up with commercials. Well, international versions are 52 minutes.
Well, luckily, we don't have that problem here. Now, are you ever allowed to visit the living quarters in the death row with a camera?
No. That's off limits, and, of course, executions cannot be covered, and I would never go to an execution. And even if you paid me $1 million to film something like this, I wouldn't do it. So it's prohibitive. There's no debate about it.
But these prisoners are allowed visitors under certain conditions.
They are, yes. Conditions are simple. You have to get in contact with them in writing only if they invite you for a discourse on camera. You have to do the next step, and that is you have to talk to the prison authorities for permission. And if the warden says yes, and if normally the attorneys of an inmate have no objections, then you can proceed.
And you get one shot at it, at least, for
yes.
quite a bit of time.
not quite, well, you get 50 minutes or 60 minutes, 1 hour, and you can continue the discourse, but there has to be a hiatus of at least 3 months in between. It's understandable that the prison authorities do not want to have an inmate on a daily or weekly basis on a talk show, for example.
Mm-hmm. At the outset of the films, you state your respectful, using that word, opposition to capital punishment. Why was it important to state that for your audience? Because that's irrelevant to the overall sense of what these films are about.
It is relevant if you look at me, if you just listen to my accent. I am German, or rather Bavarian, and looking at my historical background, coming from a country that under the Nazi barbarism had an incredible amount of capital punishment, parallel to that, a systematic program of euthanasia. If you were insane or retarded, you would be killed off by the state. And on top of it, genocide of 6 million Jewish people. So it's absolutely clear that me or no one of my peers can be an advocate of capital punishment. But having said that, as a German, I could be the last one who would try to tell the American people how to handle their criminal justice.
Did you also?
Very last one. So, of course, I say being a German and being a guest in your country, I respectfully disagree with the practice of capital punishment. Having done this statement in the first 60 seconds of the film, I do not discuss it any further.
Did you let the inmates know of your position? Would you
of course,
have?
Yes.
Would you have done so if you were for the death penalty?
I do not. I can only speculate, but I let them know I'm not an advocate of capital punishment. Very briefly, secondly, are you willing to talk to me, even though what I'm doing here, the film that I'm doing here, is not going to be a platform. Mm-hmm. It should not be a platform for you to prove your innocence. For that, you have your attorneys and you have support groups.
And when they start talking about the inconsistencies of their trial as they see it, you stop them usually and get back to the story itself.
If there are some sort of injustices in the procedural way, yes, I have sympathy for them. But, for example, in Into the Abyss, Michael Perry, who was executed only 8 days later after I talked to him, I tell him within the first 120 seconds, Mr. Perry, the fact that your childhood was complicated does not really exonerate you, but I respect you as a human being, but it does not necessarily mean that I have to like you.
Well, there's a powerful moment in one of the films, the one about Linda Carty, when the district attorney makes reference to humanizing these inmates at the risk of forgetting the victims.
Yes. Well, in that moment, I let her talk and she explains herself, and I just remark at the end, Madam, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to humanize Linda Carty on death row. She is a human being, period. And that's my attitude. I can respect them as human beings. And none of them is a monster. You see, the crimes are monstrous, but the perpetrators are always human beings.
How did you find these five individuals?
Well, in principle, I would say I went through databases. For example, you can access all inmates on death row in Texas or Florida. There's there would be a mugshot in this brief 10-line or so description of the crime they committed and when they were sentenced and things like this. So you can go through it, and there's a careful, almost like casting. But I'm speaking now of feature films, but it's an equivalent. And I was looking for persons who were of special fascination for me, or crimes, like in Into the Abyss, where the crime was incomprehensible for me and still is incomprehensible because it was so nihilistic, it was so senseless. and very frightening for me to see that. So that's why I chose this particular case.
And these people were all quite articulate, intelligent, well-schooled in the legal system. And they all gave you pretty compelling interviews. Were you surprised by that? One of them even had read something you'd written.
No, he didn't know who I was, in this case, Hank Skinner. But I had a chance to speak to him a second time 5 months later. Hank Skinner is married. He married while he was already on death row, a French woman. And he had letter contact with his wife, and she explained to him who I was. I gave him my name in the first discourse, and I said to him, well, I have made feature films. I'm from Bavaria. I make documentaries. Okay, you are not a journalist. I said, no, I'm not a journalist. I'm a poet. And we had a very fine discourse. But and all of a sudden he had learned through his wife that I had made feature films that had some impact. But otherwise, it's not that they were very, yes, they were all eloquent, but for example, in Into the Abyss, I talked to a young man who was an illiterate until very recently, and just in jail, in prison, learned how to read and write. And he tells me about a fight he had where his opponent stabbed him with a 15-inch long screwdriver through his entire chest, and how he survived it and went roofing an hour later on the roof of a house. And I have a wonderful discourse, but the man had no formal education, and yet I have the most wonderful, intense discourse with him.
My guest is Werner Herzog, whose Death Row Portraits for Films will be screened at the IFC Center today and tomorrow. The Hank Skinner, who you mentioned, is accused of killing his girlfriend and her two mentally disabled children. And he's a bit of a jokester on camera with a really raucous laugh. There are moments when he even makes you chuckle. Did you have any reservations about engaging that way with him, or was it a completely natural reaction?
I think it was quite natural, and Hank Skinner is a great storyteller, and for at least moments, 15 minutes, 20 minutes in our discourse, he's completely oblivious that he's on death row, and it's almost liberating for him, and he tells about his wildest dreams and about a washing machine and the ecstasy of just pressing a button and it starts to rotate, and he's very exhilarating, and besides, we do not really know whether he's guilty or not. We just don't know. He actually had won a very significant landmark decision at the Supreme Court of the United States, which is way beyond his own case. So remains to be seen. Apparently, there will be DNA tested after the trial, things that were not put into evidence.
Joseph Garcia was present, wasn't even present when an officer was shot, but he's on death row for the murder.
Well, there's the law of parties. If you form a criminal gang, let's say in the course of a bank robbery, and you're already outside in the getaway car, one of your gang members shoots a guard, you're all equally responsible. It doesn't matter who pulled the trigger. So it's debatable how good or how bad this law is, but in Texas it's a valid law, and in many other states, the law of parties. What was significant in his case and his co-defendant, George Rivas, who was actually executed 8 weeks ago, was the fact that they broke out from prison, from a maximum security prison, and only later, during a robbery, a policeman was shot. Unfortunately, tragically, a policeman was shot. And what puts these men, these two men, Garcia and Rivas, very close to each other, that their punishments for prior crimes were completely out of proportion. Rivas served 31 consecutive life sentences for committing robberies. Let's say he would hold up a Walmart or a Radio Shack and pretending to be a security guard, and that there were thefts. bring me in the manager and the entire staff. I have to brief them on security. And then he would, when everybody was together, he would pull his gun and say, sorry, guys, I have to lock you in the back room. Keep quiet. Don't do any stupid. Don't do anything stupid. I'm going to go for the cash now. For every single person that, whom he locked away, he got one life sentence. He was serving 31 life sentences plus 99 years for when he broke out of the prison, 99 years for taking the maintenance truck of maintenance worker and driving it through the gates out into freedom and leaving it 2 miles away from there. 99 years for that.
Well,
so 31 life sentence consecutive plus 99 years.
Verdi, we have very little time, but I want to talk about one other thing. A common thread among the inmates was their time on death row is soul-destroying, oppressive, brutal, yet they appear, at least on camera, as healthy, thoughtful, very tempered individuals. And they don't reveal any fears about death. Do you feel that they've all come to terms with what will probably eventually happen to them?
In a way, yes. I mean, they had long, long years to contemplate the possibilities. But, of course, what makes him so fascinating is that we do not know when we are going to die and how we are going to die, but they know.
One of them, James Barnes, was obviously quite manipulative. Did you feel like you were involved in some kind of duel with him?
Sometimes a little bit, yes, but at the same time, he trusted in me and he didn't trust in the legal system anymore. And the second time I met him, he confessed 2 more murders to me on camera.
That they did not know about?
Nobody knew about it. In one case, it was a missing persons case. In another case, back in the late 80s, yes, a body of a woman was found in a ditch, decomposing in a ditch, but nobody had any idea who did it.
Werner Herzog's Death Row Portraits are screening at the IFC Center on the Avenue of the Americas in Greenwich Village today and tomorrow, and the director will be there at all the screenings. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much as well. Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, Edward Humes traces what happens to the 102 tons of trash that the average American produces after it's picked up from the curb. Then Andre Gregory talks about Louis Malle's last film, which captured a performance of Uncle Vanya that was staged at a crumbling 42nd Street theater in the 1990s. A History of the World in 100 Objects looks at a two-headed serpent mosaic from Aztec Mexico. Plus, on Backstory, a look at the controversy surrounding the Texas State Board of Education's negotiations about what goes into the state's textbooks and why it affects the rest of the 49 states. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan's the executive producer, and we had help today from Ellen Frankman, Todd McGovern, Sarah Waltuck, and contributing producer Christina Maldonado. Jason Isaac was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.